Welcome, everybody, to episode 252 of the Metabolis 2 podcast, which features two people, one of which is me, Ben.
And I am David, the other person on this podcast.
Of the two, yes. I've suddenly realized a lot of twos. But anyway, yes. So what are we discussing this time?
I thought since the first male companion, William Russell, as Ian Chesterton, passed sadly during the month of June, I believe it was. And I think it's far past time that we paid our respects to Mr. William Russell Enoch.
Mr. William Russell Enoch, yes. I think that's... Have we done or paid your respects episode before?
I don't think we have.
Have we had someone as exalted as William Russell?
Probably, but
I think so.
But we haven't.
No, we haven't. Yeah, I'm just trying to think. But William Russell was a grand old 99 years old when he died.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Let's see, 5 months shy of his 100th birthday, so yeah, 99 and a half.
He was weirdly exactly the same age as my father. I see.
Really?
No, he was actually slightly younger than my father by about 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, there you go. A bit of my own trivia there. So, yeah, okay, let's talk about William Russell Enoch.
I think focusing in on his contribution to Doctor Who, because, well, this is a Doctor Who podcast, of course, but that is what most people would be familiar with. That's his surviving, miraculously, all but Marco Polo has some of his 2 years on Doctor Who. All are extant to some degree. The Crusades, of course, is missing two episodes, but other than that, his work
is pretty there,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's safe to say the show would not be... Well, I don't think it would have even gotten off the ground without him. He was pretty dependable action, the action hero of early Doctor Who.
Yes, you know, I mean, I think the key part here is that I don't think the original conception of the show, that the Doctor was really... wasn't the hero of the show.
No, he wasn't. Certainly didn't act that way.
Certainly not with his old, I've kind of bashed your head in now. So when they were coming up with the show, it was like, well, okay, we've got a cantankerous old time traveler of some kind. Mm-hmm. Mysterious, his name is Doctor Who.
Right.
Who's the hero? Who's the hero? The hero's got to be a young guy. He's got to be an action guy. He's got to be able to do stuff. He's got to be able to ride a horse and jump off things. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go to William Russell? Because we already know that he can do all that stuff because mm-hmm. he was in Sir Lancelot,
yep.
Where there was a lot of, I've never seen it, but I'm going to say, a lot of riding around on horses and jumping off things. That's why I think they hired him, right?
Pretty much so. Yeah, handsome
devil.
I think just shy of 40 years old when he took on the role of Ian. Because let's see, he was born in 24 and 63. That's 39 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. But he had one of those old fashioned kind of, you know, faces where it's really hard to tell how old he was at any point in his life. Certainly when we ran into him in, when did we run into him?
2018, something like that.
Yeah. 2018. He's an incredibly youthful looking bloke, to be honest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of timeless. And it did show when, like, he did the linking narration for the Crusade, that he still had that twinkle. And then just with his appearances subsequently with Big Finish, where he played Ian Chesterton in Companion Chronicles and stuff.
Well, and when they had him for, when he was played the doorman for Adventures in Time and Space, when he must have been in his 90s.
Yeah.
Right? He must have been in his 90s, but he was able to play like a BBC doorman. I mean, I don't know what the mandatory age for retirement for BBC doorman is, but it's certainly younger than in your 90s. Mm-hmm. He did an excellent job mm-hmm. on that one. Yeah, he's a weirdly young, it's a strange young old face.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's kind of the voice of that World War II generation, so to speak, where, I mean, the types of things that they would have Ian do, like just in the Daleks, where he's trying to get Aladon to fight against the Daleks, and just the kind of the moral center when he's chastising the Doctor, saying we're having them fight to recover the fluid link. And I think he represented, he was kind of the everyman moral center just as Barbara was the every woman moral center of early 1960s Britain.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think, again, it's interesting that they're teachers.
Mm.
I'm not sure that we would have teachers that were quite so morally centered and kind of just generally heroic in, you know, more contemporary.
Well, we certainly didn't, because we had Clara and Danny Pink, which, you know,
that's true.
Coal Hill School teachers, and not the same as Ian and Barbara.
Not the same as Ian and Barbara. And of course, Barbara, a history teacher, and Ian, a science teacher,
mm-hmm.
which, again, is perfect. I mean, the Doctor lucked out with those two companions, because, of course, Ian can handle the science, potentially, mm-hmm. and Barbara can handle the history,
right.
potentially. Obviously, you know, as the show develops and morphs and changes and reacts to having to be written and shot
mm-hmm.
really quite quickly, more quickly than it probably needs to, should have been done, you know, that kind of character stuff starts to break down a little bit. But certainly in that first season, it's Barbara who's handling the history stuff, and it is Ian who's handling all of the action-packed and not really science stuff,
yeah,
but man stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, man stuff.
Anything that would be subsequently the role of the Doctor, the, you know, especially by the time John Pertwee took over the role, it was kind of the action hero. But anything that was considered to be fisticuffs, sword fighting, what have you, that's going to be Ian.
Right.
And where it does stand out is when William Hartnell has a few scenes in The Romans where he's dealing with an assassin, would-be assassin for Maximum Petelius or whatever the
right
liar whatever. Player he was masquerading as. It does stand out, and I think, you know, if you look at each story, I mean, he has a fight scene in the Daleks, and Marco Polo, he's going against Tigana, Aztec, you know, he's fighting Reign of Terror. He's more of the leading man than Hartnell is.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about some of those historicals. I mean, I think it's interesting that he's often the question-answering character.
Mm-hmm.
Or the question-asking person, because it's Barbara who knows the history of the Reign of Terror and the Marco Polos mm-hmm. and the Aztecs and, you know, all the other kind of
Romans,
history stuff.
Right.
Romans. And it's Ian who's blundering about going like, I don't know what's going on here because I'm just a science teacher. So she is able to explain to Ian, because obviously they're very close.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the doctor already knows this stuff, so he's not going to be asking questions.
Right.
And then Susan's off somewhere else.
Now, do you think this show could have worked without that dynamic, if you had the more Pertwee dynamic early on, rather than have Ian in there along with Barbara, having the adults in the room?
That's a good question. I mean, I actually like the way you put it. You say adults in the room, and I think it gives the Doctor character a chance to be alien and different and, you know, in some ways, therefore childish
mm-hmm.
without that being weird, too weird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, these two teachers, and I think, you know, the show is for kids. And it is the early 1960s, and it's written by people who were born in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teachers are people that you look up to, and they're as much mentors as they are divulgers of information. And again, as we've just said, you know, those two are the kind of moral center of the show, and they allow Susan and they allow the Doctor to be aliens,
mm-hmm.
And they allow us to see both history and science fiction through the eyes of people that we know and trust. And it would have been a very different show. You know, I'm thinking it would have been more, I don't know, what Doctor Who would have been like had it just been the Doctor and then a human. And maybe it would have been more like My Favorite Martian or something.
Mm.
It's like, here's the weird alien and I'm just a normal person. Like, I don't know, I dream of Genie, only the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't think it would have been very different. And who knows what would have happened. I'm not sure it would have lasted as well, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
You kind of set up the whole Nutty Professor type thing early on, and you can't go beyond that. The Doctor's character doesn't transform at all. And
right.
It's the contrast of the amoralness of the Doctor versus the morality of Ian and Barbara, pretty much.
Yeah. And then normalcy as well. I mean, they're the kind of moral center of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they allow more variety in what the Doctor's up to and what Susan is up to. Because, you know, we're discovering the Doctor and Susan's world, or worlds with a plural, through the eyes of these teachers.
Mm-hmm. And then again, when Susan departs in the Dalek invasion of Earth, we have Vicky mm-hmm. coming on board, and Barbara and Ian sort of act as, again, surrogate parent for, you know, the orphan Vicky.
Right, right.
And they're friendly, but they're also kind of a step-parent, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, they're old-fashioned in the very best kind of way. I mean, they're not married, but they may as well be, and I think, you know, fan lore has the...
Definitely
know,
has them as a couple.
Yeah, exactly. And they kind of, you know, legalized their relationship after the phrase is, you know, after they left the TARDIS, and they are, you know, they're the mother and father of these kids, two sets, you know, one kid and then another kid, another child, and in some ways they're also, you know, there's, we talked about moral center, you know, they're the caretakers, mother and father figure, daughter and son and daughter of the Doctor.
Those first 12 stories really are the adventures of Barbara and Ian. We see pretty much the time traveling from their perspective, and from being abducted at on an unearthly child, and then trying to smooth out the roughness of the Doctor. By the time that they get the opportunity to leave, by the end of the chase with the Dalek time machine, that they're pretty much done. And I could imagine the show at that point ending.
Right.
With Ian and Barbara, their adventure is over. You could see the Doctor and Vicky looking at their time-space visualizer. And it's the very next episode with the Time Meddler that things kind of go off the rails of what's been before. We get the first introduction of there's another TARDIS with the introduction
right,
of the monk.
Right.
You met someone from the Doctor's culture at that point. So immediately upon their departure, you've refocused on Doctor Who, answering that question, who is the Doctor?
And it is kind of obvious the way that you put it. As soon as Barbara and Ian leave, things change, and, you know, those first two seasons, we've been told, you know, we can't change history, not one line. First thing happens when those guys leave is that, yes, you can change history. You can give the Saxons machine guns or whatever the meddling monk's plan is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that kind of moral center, not strongly, it flies out of the window, but certainly begins to change. And we have a crew of the TARDIS who are not... I mean, Stephen is from Earth, but he's not from 20th century Earth.
Right.
Neither is Vicky. And we're kind of off having space adventures at that point. We're not trying to get home, and we're not people that you might meet in your everyday life if you're a child
right.
and you go to school, or if you have parents. We're now with a bunch of characters who are, you know, space characters.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, in inverted commas, relatable mid-20th century adults anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 12 with Ian and Barbara versus the 12 without Ian and Barbara is a very clear demarcation in the style of story and what the show is about when they're with the show and then after with the show. And it forces the production team to sort of reinvent the show, because you no longer have the formula where you have the action man and the earth woman.
Right, right.
And you're leaning heavily like on a Steven Taylor type character. And I don't think it's quite as effective there, because when you have something like Galaxy 4, there's not a lot of action. And the action there is where you're missing like a Barbara type character.
Yeah, yeah. It's clear. I mean, obviously, we love this show, and, you know, all of it is good and interesting to people like us. But it's clear to me that the show starts to wobble when Ian and Barbara go, not necessarily because we're losing two really great actors, but we're losing two useful characters who we're going to repeat ourselves are anchors of some kind. They anchor what's going on to something that is directly relatable to us, which is it's 1963 or 1964. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we have characters who don't really care about 1963 or 1964 and are from places that are radically different from that place, the writers, I think, start to feel more challenged. And I think, it's kind of instructive that right towards the end of Hartnell's run, we get introduced to two new actual Earthbound characters, Ben and Polly, who are, it's kind of fascinating. This is why this show is so endlessly fascinating. They aren't teachers anymore. They're a sailor and a dolly bird from swinging London rather than a history teacher and a science teacher from your school. That's the kind of arc of those first 3 years.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, again, when you bring up Ben and Polly, because they are the second couple that we've had on the show. And
right.
We don't have another couple until Amy and Rory in the Smith era. So
right.
They were
right.
Trying to, I think, recapture what they had with Ian and Barbara, but it obviously they're younger and it's 2 years later and it just doesn't, they're different characters.
It's different.
Yeah.
It's different. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, even in those 2 years, British culture has changed so radically in some ways that actually having, let's have two more teachers from your secondary school. That's just not going to fly.
Right.
What we have to have is we have to have a cool, like, cool sailor sounds weird, but you know what I mean. Like a young guy and his cool girlfriend, or not girlfriend, his cool friend who happens to be a girl, who go to nightclubs and who are more Susan-oriented than, orientated than they are Ian and Barbara-orientated in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I think that William Russell and Jacqueline Hill left is their contracts were expiring at the end of the chase, and they obviously or probably wanted to move on to and do other work than what they've been doing for the past 2 years. But looking at what's coming afterwards with the Time Meddler through, say, DMP, do you think there would have been a role for them hanging around, or do you think their exit is about as good as they could have gotten?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great exit. I think the chase is an excellent ending point for them, and I think it is an excellent starting point for a newish version of the show with Stephen Taylor coming in. I mean, I think, you know, one of the issues is that it's, you know, Ian and Barbara have not really made no secret of the fact that they'd like to get back to London, please.
Right.
And I think kind of Blake Seven-wise, you know, obviously at some point you've got to find Blake if you're looking for him, because otherwise it just gets ridiculous.
Right.
You know, at some point it's a time machine that also travels in space. You're going to get them back to London. They will get back to London at some point, and to have them sort of keep on being like, well, why can't we? We'd much rather just go home right now. To me, it would have become sort of untenable, maybe a little bit hard to keep moving, in my opinion. But I think they are such grounded characters that any more kind of sort of spacey impetus that we might want to have done, that we might want to have kind of engaged with Stephen's an astronaut, you know, Vicky's from space, etc., etc., etc. That's hard to do with Ian and Barbara because they're not spacey people. They're your history teacher and they're your science teacher from your secondary school, and they are as square. I mean, we all love Ian / William Russell. I don't know who actually was doing the dancing in the chase.
The dad dance, whether
William Russell was like, okay, Ian's a big square, I'm going to dance like a square would dance, or whether that's just how William Russell danced, because he was also a big square. I don't know. But, you know, they're very super grounded people. They're not wild and crazy and spacey and 60s-y and science fiction-y and anything like that. You know, I mean, they're not even... you know, they're not even not English, if you see what I mean. You know, I mean, I'm trying to think of sort of, you know, equivalents, you know, if they'd been Americans or something, that would have been something else. But, you know, they're just as a sort of dull, but in the best way that you could possibly think.
Grounded. Grounded, I think.
Grounded, exactly, which is a polite way of saying dull, I think. and I mean, to keep kind of stringing them along by like, nope, not going to take you home. Nope, you're not going to get home. Nope, sorry. It would have just, you know, I can see them breaking at some point, to be honest.
Well, it's literally the first opportunity they have. I can't think of any, you know, everything else has been in the future or the past in Earth. They literally have the time machine that is more reliable than the TARDIS.
Right.
And they're going to take their chance, you know, and it's their chance to take. And the Doctor is, you know, you're taking a big risk, but, you know, narratively, they're not going to fail. The production team of 1965 is not going to have Ian and Barbara
spin-off
blow up in the Dalek time machine. Yeah, spin-off.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this is a point. I mean, you know, we're not going to have the Ian and Barbara adventures where they have their own time machine. They're like Clara and Clara's girlfriend who have their own time machine at this point in the contemporary version of the show.
Right.
Theoretically, they've got a TARDIS. They could just TARDIS around and have their own adventures. But they don't want to do that. they want to go back home to 1965. They don't want to go around the universe, you know, solving crimes and looking at stuff. They don't even want to go through the history of Earth, like solving crimes and looking at stuff. They want to go back to the early 1960s, and they want to go back and they want to teach in the secondary school, in Coal Hill Secondary School, is what they really, really want to do.
Yep, Ian sets the TARDIS ablaze or blows it up.
Or whatever. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, he doesn't have to. It would have been very convenient to have a TARDIS at your beck and call if you wanted to find out what next week's lottery numbers were going to be or win the pools or something. But that doesn't occur to someone like Ian because that would be cheating and you know, wouldn't be cricket. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, that we don't really question their... You know, I think, you know, especially when we look at the, you know, the contemporary iteration of the show where, you know, it's all about this big adventure and it's the ride of your life and kind of see the universe and we can go back and see some dinosaurs and meet Isaac Newton and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These first two companions don't really think that's that great. And they would actually really just like to get back to the London in the early 1960s, please.
I mean, if you look at what they've been through, their ordeals that they've had traveling with the Doctor, I mean, you cannot blame them for wanting just to be, let's resume our life 2 years later and let's not get into any kind of crazy shenanigans with a Dalek
ever
time
again.
Machine. Yeah.
Ever again. Which, again, I think is kind of interesting because, again, if putting it like that, their reaction is completely logical and understandable. And what isn't logical and understandable is our current slew of companions, their excitement about being dragged off around the universe to be attacked by various hideous aliens doesn't make any sense at all. As I think people have pointed out, Rose Tyler should have been a gibbering wreck at, you know, after the first couple of episodes.
Yeah.
You know.
Same thing with our most recent companion.
Exactly.
Ruby Sunday is...
Yeah.
It's almost as if modern companions have a death wish compared to what Ian and Barbara, they wanted to survive, they wanted to get back home. And that works well with the abduction by the cantankerous Doctor during Unearthly Child.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to kind of extemporize on the point that we're making here, it makes Ian and Barbara a lot more realistic.
True.
Possibly than actually any of the other companions. Well, you know,
I mean, I think you look at the companions that we had in the early 70s with Joe and Harry and Sarah, all three of them, even Liz Shaw, they all seemed more grounded.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Doctor. My time was there, but I'm moving on with my life.
Absolutely. And I think as much as we might enjoy contemporary Doctor Who, in some ways we maybe slightly lost sight of that. In that as awesome and as fun as it might be to travel the universe with a Doctor, it's also pretty dangerous and it's also pretty confusing and unusual. You know, and you could be a very broad-minded young person who, you know, spends a lot of time thinking about how things should be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if you're confronted by a bunch of Daleks or Cybermen or worse, yeah, that's a scary thing. And Ian and Barbara and our other classic companions wanting to get back to their normal lives makes a lot of sense.
I think that's the difference between fans writing the show and non-fans writing the show. Fans, such as you and me, we don't ever leave the show.
Right.
We always take it with us. While a jobbing writer from the 1960s and 1970s, this is just a job.
Right.
And they weren't fans because it didn't exist when they were children. So I think it's kind of a reflection on having a Davis and a Moffat, et cetera, writing for the program is they haven't ever left their childhood obsession behind. They can't imagine leaving Doctor Who behind.
They can't imagine not wanting to be in the TARDIS for as long as possible. Whereas people who are sitting down and like writing The Chase, Terry Nation, is like, well, of course, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, they want to go home. All right. Okay. Here they go. And of course they want to go home. And again, you know, I think it's just to kind of repeating myself, and this is what makes the, I think study is obviously the wrong word, but you know, this is what makes observing Doctor Who such a fun thing to do, because it is such an accurate representation of how particularly British society has changed in every way since from 1963 to 2024. Things are very different, and the way that we live and the way that we think about our lives and the way that we relate to each other and the way that we relate to people in authority and the way that we make television shows and the way that we make science fiction and the way we talk about things is different from year to year to year to year. We've already made the point, you know, that the two human companions that the Doctor starts out with in 1963 is very, very different from the two human companions he ends up with in 1966. So, yeah, I mean, this is what makes the show so fun, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to throw something in. Are we going to tackle Mordrin Undead?
Well, he was, Ian Russell was, or not Ian Russell, Ian Chesterton. Ian Chesterton was the character that JNT and crew wanted, but due to reasons, they came up with the Brigadier instead.
Yeah, which always, I can remember being confused at the time, and I think we've probably covered this when we've talked about Mordrin Undead before, being confused why that was the Brigadier, and it's only since I've become a fan, you know, a proper fan of the show, i.e. reading about it, that I've been told, and it makes utter sense, that that was supposed to be Ian, which would have been marvellous, actually, and I'm really very sorry that William Russell wasn't able to bring that character back, because I think it would have been... I think it would have been very different, and I think it would have been actually better in many ways. I would love to have seen Peter Davison and William Russell work together as, you know, a Doctor who is just so much younger than the Doctor that Ian first met just, you know, sort of 20 years previous or so.
I would have only liked it if Jaclyn Hill came back at the same time in Mordrin Undead.
Oh, you would have had the... which again, I mean, she could have been teaching history in the same... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Weird public school.
Yeah. But for that reason alone, I'm kind of glad that...
Okay.
I mean, I'm not very keen on Ian Chesterton's reprised role, that brief cameo at the end of The Power of the Doctor. I think it wasn't necessarily true to his character where... I had a problem with the big support group of former companions, and I thought it kind of cheapened... the senior statesman of the William Hartnell era.
I don't know whether we covered this when we talked about Power of the Doctor. I can't actually remember. I think that whole thing was daft. I mean, I think it was nice to see everybody, but it was a little, it didn't make any sense according to their characters. And it also didn't make sense that some of them were there and some of them weren't. And it didn't make sense that it's like AA, and it basically didn't make sense.
Yeah.
It was a piece of fanish thing that obviously Chibnall wanted to do, and I think someone should have talked him out of it.
Yeah, I think it worked better when Sarah Jane Adventure, where Matt Smith was in, where they just kind of name checked that Barbara and Ian never aged, etc. But I'm not sorry to see him not return, I guess, because for audiences in the 1980s, the Brigadier was probably more accessible than Ian. Ian hadn't been on the screens since 65, and what, that was 85?
More than it was. I thought it was 83. I thought it was the anniversary.
Yeah, you know, 83, but still.
Whatever, yeah.
It's still been more than a decade, and Lethbridge Stewart was last on with, Zygons in 75.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's hard, actually. I mean, it's funny. I mean, how, as we get old, you know, time changes. it's 20 plus, almost 20 years since New Who started. Mm-hmm. Which means that, you know, it's like being in the mid 80s and thinking about the early 1960s, mm-hmm. which when I, in the mid 1980s, the early 1960s were like those, that was hundreds of years ago to me.
Yes.
When actually wasn't that long ago at all, if I was my age then, which of course I'm not.
So looking at the roles that William Russell did as Ian, do you have any particular favorites of the stories that's his standouts for you?
No, that's a good question. This is going to sound bad, first off, but actually it's meant to be good. They don't really stand out. He's a consistently decent, honest, vaguely heroic, slightly gormless, you know, like the cliche of the idiot dad in the commercial, male hero-ish figure, all the way through. There's not a lot of nuance to his character other than that he's a science teacher. And that he's younger than the Doctor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically his character. There isn't a particular point that I can think of right now in any of the episodes that he is in where he does something that is like, whoa, that's amazing. He's saved the day. Without Ian, we would all been lost. He doesn't do anything out of character, basically. And as I said, his character is two note in some ways. You know, I'm a science teacher. And I'm younger than the other male. That being said, I do like his dancing in the chase.
For me, he's the glue, so to speak, of the program. And there's a scene in Dalek Invasion where David Campbell tries to play to the Hartnell Doctor, you know, saying, sir, for your advice and being the senior of our party and whatnot. We don't get that with Ian. We don't get that deference. He has seen the Doctor from the beginning and knows that he isn't the one with all the answers and more likely to brain the caveman than negotiate. I think where Ian stands out is he is probably less error-prone than the Doctor. He doesn't make the mistakes that puts people in jeopardy. He's there as the backstop. And
right.
Even like in the chase when they're on Eridus and they want to escape, he comes up with a plan that works with Hartnell's Doctor to, you know, hide behind the sand dunes and distract the Daleks so they can topple it over the cliff.
Right.
He is the logician. He is the strategic thinker. And it's those type of themes, whether they be in the Daleks or him throwing his weight around with the trappers in the Keys of Marinus.
Right.
He's solid. He's consistent. He's the glue. He's the man of action. He's not going to let down your side.
He's utterly reliable. He's utterly dependable. You know how he's going to react in any situation. And there's no surprises. There's no surprises with Ian. And there's no surprises, really, from William Russell's performance, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no origin story for Ian. You know, his parents weren't gunned down in an alley by the Joker or something. You know, he's not. he's just a regular guy. Mm-hmm. He's just a regular, I'm a science teacher from a school. And just thinking about, you know, contemporary dramas and, you know, how everyone has got to have a side to them. I'm adopted. I've got to find out who my mother is. And also then I guess my father too. Everyone's got to have a whole thing. And Ian does not have a whole thing. Ian's just I'm a science teacher.
Do you think a regular guy could work in the TARDIS anymore as a companion? Do you think there's a room for an Ian Chesterton?
Well, I mean, we have had Graham, but of course Graham has got his grandson with him, and he's got cancer, and his wife is dead in some way. You know, it's a checklist of like, okay, these are some things that will help the actor find who the character is, because like these are the things that happens to him. We've got who's the Liverpudlian guy with Jodie, you know, who didn't really end up being a companion that much, you know, the comedian
Bishop.
Yes.
No, I can't remember what his character's name is. So.
He's called... I'm going to call him...
Tim the Enchanter.
I'm going to call him Derek. He volunteers at a soup kitchen. Doesn't know soup kitchen. Food shelf. But he also volunteers at the museum as well. And he's got some parents. And he's got a girlfriend. And he's got a woman he really fancies. But like, it's a kind of unrequited girlfriend-boyfriend mm-hmm. thing. And, you know, he's from Liverpool.
Dan Lewis is who we're talking about.
Dan Lewis. He's from Liverpool, for God's sake. You know, which is... you know, I mean, Ian isn't from somewhere. You know, Coal Hill is supposed to be in the East End of London, but Ian isn't from the East End of London.
Definitely not.
Ian is as middle class as you can possibly get. So I don't think you could have a character like... I mean, a character like that would be laughed at by contemporary drama. And again, this is repeating myself. I think this is why the show is so endlessly interesting. Because, okay, why can't we have a character like that now?
Hmm.
And there's lots of interesting and valid reasons why a character like that would fail in a contemporary setting, or at least writers wouldn't want to write that character. We don't have writers who can write that person anymore.
So the character is too boring for contemporary audiences.
I think boring is the wrong word. I think just too non-interesting.
Too stable.
Too stable. too not dramatic enough. I mean, one could make, and we're kind of making the argument here, okay, well, so much drama happens to a Doctor Who companion. Why does that companion themselves also have to have drama, if you see what mm-hmm. I mean? Isn't that actually too much drama? Because getting attacked by Daleks every week is certainly would be drama enough for me. If I was in the TARDIS, without then having to be endlessly concerned about who my mother and, by extension, father was.
It's a change from a plot-driven adventure story to a character-driven soap opera story, where you need the characters to have the backstory or the conflicts to make the drama that's currently being told in Doctor Who, I would expect.
Well, I mean, this has been your... I think you made that criticism very explicit the last time we podcasted and said, okay, you know, this is no longer the show that I fell in love with,
yeah.
Which is an adventure show. It's a, like, let's have an adventure. And that's not mean let's have an adventure. Isn't adventure awesome? It's like adventure is like bloody scary as well. But I mean, I don't think the kind of characters that Ian is a product of a time and a place in terms of the writing of serialized TV drama.
Right.
And you just don't write those characters don't exist on serialized TV drama anymore. It is kind of ironic if we're talking about soap opera and William Russell, you know, I think his other, you know, one of his other major roles was in Coronation Street as well, right? Wasn't he in Coronation Street for a while?
Seriously?
Yeah, he was in Coronation Street. 46 episodes of Coronation Street for 1 year. So he wasn't in Coronation Street for very long, but he was Ted Sullivan in Coronation Street in 1992 for 46 episodes. I've never watched Coronation Street, so I can't have any opinion on that. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it, in some ways, having just found out that fact relatively recently, it would be interesting to actually try and watch some of those episodes of Coronation Street and see what he's like. But anyway, yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't know what his character was. What his character was called, it says here, Ted Sullivan. I don't know whether he was evil or not, whether he had to put on a Manchester accent.
We'll have to refer to our colleagues at the Coronation Street podcast.
The long-running Coronation Street. Okay, here we are. We're on the Coronation Street wiki here, and we're looking up Ted Sullivan. And Ted Sullivan, Edward John Ted Sullivan, was a salesman for Cartwright's Confectionery and husband of Doris Sullivan. Ted and Doris had no children and lived in a big house in 16 Highbank Avenue, Oak Hill. Some years before 1992, Doris drowned in a fishing accident. So again, there you go. As he approached retirement age, Ted has a number of health problems. So, yeah, he had an operation to remove a brain tumor. So, you know, yes, he did play a soap opera character with a bunch of soap opera stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, what's interesting is, of course, when we're, you know, if we're implying that the kind of tabula rasa science teacher that Russell embodied as Ian in the first part of Doctor Who, we're saying, well, that's kind of an unrealistic character nowadays. Well, actually, you know, to be honest, a kind of soap opera character in contemporary Doctor Who is also super unrealistic as well, because nobody has that much drama in their life.
Hopefully not.
Well, actually, some people do. But by and large, it's the two kind of polar opposite things, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. It's not dramatic if there's no drama happening.
Yeah.
But it is the difference between, you know, soap opera and it's the characters to adventure, where it's the adventure. And you don't want, when they're trying to beat the Daleks, for Ian suddenly to be worried about maybe his cancer's coming back. Do you really?
Probably not. No.
No, you don't. You know, you don't. Absolutely don't. Like, oh no, it's like we're on the radiation planet. Maybe I'm going to get cancer again. Yeah. You don't want him to be worried about that.
Yeah.
You want him to be out there kicking ass and taking names when it comes to Daleks. And it was ridiculous when that happened with Graham, where all of a sudden, like, Graham was like, oh, maybe I've got cancer again. Mm-hmm. For like 5 minutes, and then it was just back to adventuring. So it's a difficult show to write. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, I think leave it there then.
Yeah.
Looks like he was on Shoestring.
Okay, this is now going to be us reading the Wikipedia entry for. What was he on Shoestring? Was he? He wasn't a regular.
No, he played the character David Kern in episode Privateer in 1979. So.
Okay, he's in a lot of stuff. Oh yes, Shoestring. There we go. Yeah, play for. He was in The Professionals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's like an excellent. He was in Blackadder, for God's sake, apparently as the Duke of Winchester, and then he was in Robin of Sherwood as the Duke of Gloucester. I think he had a pretty good career as an actor.
Yep.
And, like, you know, fair play, basically.
Yep.
Fair play to him.
And he always returned to Doctor Who, so it was fun. I guess the story I like to tell is how we had breakfast right next to the table, right next to him and his lovely wife, Ethelina, at Gallifrey at the LAX Marriott there. And being Gallifrey, one as is the custom, no one gave him any grief, and they had a nice breakfast, and it just was pretty chill, being we're a table away from Ian Chesterton.
Sorry, that was my very first Gallifrey one, and I didn't really know what was possible, and I'm sorry I didn't actually do a coffee clutch or whatever with William Russell, or, you know, I don't think he even went to a panel with him, to be honest. Which I'm sorry about. And I would like to have got his signature on something, but I didn't. So
not sure he was signing, but he did do...
He wasn't signing.
He did some panels. He did talked about his time in the Second World War on one of the panels. That
really?
Was quite interesting, yeah.
Oh, what did he do in the Second World War? What branch of the service was he in?
Oh, my gosh. Now I'm put on the spot.
Yeah, you can't say that without actually being able to back it up. Wikipedia says that he was in the Royal Air Force.
That sounds right.
Okay, good. All right. Organizing entertainment. So he was like, he was the concert party, which is fair enough. I certainly wouldn't have wanted him to go down in a flaming Lancaster over Berlin, because then we wouldn't have got him in The Great Escape. He was in The Great Escape, for God's sake. You know, with Steve McQueen and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a hero. They don't make people like William Russell anymore, basically, I don't think.
Yeah.
Do they? Which is both good and bad, I suppose.
All right.
Well.
Thank you for listening to episode 252 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been reflecting on the immortal Ian Chesterton with Ben.
And I have been reflecting on the delightful William Russell Enoch with David.
Until next time.
Farewell.